Blog Talk Radio.
Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also doing great. I'm doing great. I hope you've had a good week.
You know, easing into getting a few things done, actually. Yeah, it's been a... Been a pretty good week so far. How about you? Anything interesting going on with you?
Man, I'm just staying incredibly busy at work, which is a good thing. You know, I mean, you're sitting around with nothing to do. That can be nerve-wracking also. So, yeah, it's been a good week.
Very good. Well, I just did something that made me feel good about myself. You know, we've been promoting worthwhile causes the last few weeks, I've noticed. We talked a little bit about the Kickstarter to build a space elevator. And then we talked about the fund that was being raised to help the young lady who unfortunately is terminal with cancer and to provide a cryonic solution for her. And today, just today, I found out that Singularity One-on-One, that podcast, a production of the Singularity, I think it's just called Singularity Weblog, actually, they're doing it's not a Kickstarter campaign, it's actually over on Indiegogo campaign, and these guys, very ambitious, this guy, I should say, as far as I know, it's just the one fellow, Nikola Danilov, a.k.a. Socrates, I think is the name he uses on his blog, is looking to raise $30,000 and take Singularity One-on-One Pro. He wants to make it a full-time professional gig. Now, this is something that you and I have talked about on occasion, usually in kind of a half-joking manner for Fast Forward Radio. So I think it's very exciting to see someone who does a show in some ways, many ways, very similar to ours, actually taking this step. Have you listened to Singularity One-on-One?
You know, it's been a while since I've tuned in, but yes, I have. It's a good show.
He does some great stuff, and he gets really good guests. A lot of them have been guests also on Fast Forward Radio, and he's scored a couple that we've not yet been able to line up. So it makes for a nice.
That's hard to believe, Phil, because we've had a guest lineup that's been pretty incredible. So
we have. Well, I'll tell you. I'll tell you who, just in case he's listening.
Okay.
I've never been able to get his attention. Werner Vinge, all right, has been on Singularity One-on-One. We've not yet been able to line him up for Fast Forward Radio. So anyway, I just made a donation to Socrates and to Singularity One-on-One, and I urge everyone who's interested in this kind of program, who'd like to support this kind of program, to do exactly the same thing. I'm going to go ahead and put this in this link in the chat room, and let's all get behind Singularity One-on-One. If you're not listening to that program, I recommend it to all of our listeners. I think if you like this show, you will like it too. If you have time for only one podcast a week, and you're listening to my voice right now, I'm not going to argue with your choice. But make time for that other hour. It's a highly worthwhile show, and I wish we wish Nikola all the best. We'll be tracking this to see how he does, and just an interesting kind of development here in our. Kind of in our bailiwick here in our backyard. Now I wanted to tell you something that really caught my attention about his campaign. If I can get back to the campaign homepage. Here's what he wrote about his show. Current highlights: 2.5 years of existence, over 90 episodes and 70 interviews, 100,000-plus views on YouTube. That's a thought for me. Hey, you know what? Maybe we ought to put ours up on YouTube. 260,000-plus audio downloads on iTunes, Zune, BlackBerry Podcast, et cetera, and 2,000-plus email and RSS subscribers. Well, of course, I start reading those numbers, and it occurred to me this is a topic that we've been reminding ourselves of occasionally throughout the last few months. You know what we're coming up on here pretty soon?
It's a big round number. What is it, Phil?
Well, it's our fifth year.
With that.
we're starting.
I thought you had a number of listens.
Number of listens. You know what? I forgot to check it before I logged in as myself. I'm not logged in as you. You can actually look at that, can't you? Or do you have access to actually when you've got the
I can do it much easier when the show's not going on.
Okay, all right.
It's
something like a 500,000. I'm pretty sure it's between 500,000 and 600,000.
That was the big number I was thinking it was, as we're right at 500,000 listens. So,
well, since we've been doing this, I don't know, since the show exploded, I don't know if we've talked about this on the air. Thanks for listening, everybody. We've got a lot more listeners. We've always had a good listener base, but the last I don't know, 3 or 4 months, we've had between 5,000 and 10,000. No, I should say between 5,000 and 20,000 listens to every show, including live listens and people who listen online to the show and people who actually download the show via iTunes and other means. That number has actually gone up significantly. We've passed 500. I think we're on our way to well on our way to 600,000 total listens for the show, but. Yeah, actually, where I was going with that was he's been doing it for 2.5 years, about half the time that we've been doing it here. We've actually been doing the show since 2005, is that right? Could we have been doing it 7 years?
The same year that the podcast was invented, which was 2005, we began the show.
There you go. And we did about 25 shows prior to starting on Blog Talk Radio back in October of 2007. And I added them up today. Stephen, how many shows have we done? Do you know? Any idea?
I have no idea. But we've been really good about doing this weekly. I mean, we've missed very few weeks. I think we missed the first week in a long time, a couple of weeks ago, about a month ago maybe.
Yeah, we've missed a few this year. And we did have a brief hiatus. We missed 3 weeks in July. But you're right. Generally,
sure.
In fact, July of this year, was the month with the fewest shows ever for Fast Forward Radio, and we have done this. Tonight is our 243rd show on Blog Talk Radio.
Uh-oh.
We've done 242. That's not counting Best Ofs. We've run 40 of those and other, which would include things like The World Transformed 1.5, those little monologue shows I did, and like that first test show. I didn't count that. So if you add everything up, we've done almost 300 shows on Blog Talk Radio, but just counting the actual shows, 242. I think we've got two very auspicious occasions coming up, and I think I was talking to my wife about this at dinner earlier. Now, which of these two should we celebrate, the 5-year anniversary or the 250th show? And she looked at me like, you know, she was being patient with me as always and pointed out that why would we not celebrate both of those? And I think that's actually an excellent idea. So
we can figure out a way to time it right so that it comes out on the same night.
Oh, we'd have to do a whole bunch of shows. That's too hard. No.
That's what we do. We just we have nightly shows for a little while. Until we...
we could. I think we would need to have started planning for that a few weeks ago if we were going to do it that way. I recommend we do a kind of a two-pronged thing here. And coming up the week of... I believe it'll actually be October 10th. Will be the Wednesday of that week. October 6th was the first ever show. So October 10th we can celebrate our fifth anniversary, and then coming up 7 weeks from tonight, wherever that puts us, we can celebrate our 250th show. And so maybe we'll do a small celebration for the 5 years, and we'll see if we can't put a big thing together since we got 7 weeks to plan for it. Maybe get some of our friends who've been on the show over the years. Maybe we'll pull some audio from some of the best of and really do it upright. I think we should definitely celebrate.
Maybe make it a 2-hour
landmark,
an hour and a half at least.
I think we should
go a little longer on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, you think about this: 240 shows. Okay, 242 shows. or 243 by the time we had done tonight. An hour each, okay? That is 10 straight days of fast-forward radio. Right? I mean, if you started, it would go 10 days. And, Stephen, I want you to know that I have spent more time on the phone with you than any other human being. I'm sure.
Well, that's great. I'm not sure that that's true of me. I'm pretty much, I get to work, I sit down, I put on the headset, you know, and
I spend a lot of time on the phone, but with one person, I think.
Yeah,
It's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot over 5 years. Just an hour a week is all it takes, and in fact, it's way more than that because every time we did World Transform, those shows were 90 minutes. And looking back, especially in the first couple of years, we did a lot of 90-minute shows. We'd just get talking about something, and push it on to the next half hour. We'd tell the live guest, "Bye, we're going to keep talking now." So. you guys.
Yeah, we did that a lot. We ought to just, you know, every now and then, just for the heck of it, just do that. There's no point in not doing that every now and then. So.
we absolutely should. So we'll look for that, folks. Big celebration show coming up the week of October 10th, and even bigger 250th show coming up. Whenever that is 7 weeks from tonight. Anyway, this will all be publicized on the Speculist and Facebook and Twitter and elsewhere. We'll get the word out, and big celebration's coming. Something to look forward to.
Sounds great.
All right, so now let's delve into our topic of the evening. I feel like I didn't give the show a lofty enough title with Voyage to the End of the Universe, but. We'll try to make do.
We'll do our best with that. Huh?
Let's talk a little bit about space travel. The real idea here was we had run across some interesting developments in space. There's this news story about how warp drive might actually be possible after all. That's exciting. And it came right on the heels. Stephen, you had shared this piece from IO9 that was talking about how you can have a good, exciting science fiction story even if space opera type story, even if faster than light travel is not possible. So I was reading over that, and it had a link to another story that I thought would be a great place to start. I don't know if you've seen this, 10 myths about space travel that make science fiction better.
Okay. I did not get that one. What's it about?
Okay. So basically, faster than light is just the beginning of problems with space travel in terms of what we understand about it from our favorite science fiction stories.
Let me guess one. I'd like to guess. I'm going to see if I can just throw one out and see if I get it right.
Okay.
Artificial gravity, where they're not spinning the ship.
Absolutely. In fact, after faster-than-light travel, the number two item is you can have artificial gravity without spinning the ship. And, in fact, there's no way to have that without spinning the ship that we know of. It's just one of those plot devices. I mean, I would think that probably in written fiction, unless it's derivative of Star Trek or Star Wars or something like that, they deal with that a little bit more realistically. But whenever you're filming, it's just, you know, it's really hard to show weightlessness, and it's really easy to show people interacting with a normal gravity environment. And so they don't bother with a lot of lengthy explanations about how the artificial gravity works or where it's coming from. And one of the things that is noted in this story is that you often have these situations in Star Trek and other shows where, you know, the engines have lost power, life support's off, everything's down, but the gravity still works, right? It's like that's the thing that keeps going. Very good. Do you think you can guess any more? You're
past 1,000 so far. I don't know. That one always kind of strikes me as pretty funny. I really don't think I can.
Let me share the rest of these because I think these are all these are all very much to the point. Number three was you can stop and start without worrying about inertia.
Inertial dampeners in real life.
And in fact, one of the crazy things that they do in Star Trek is they're always talking about full stop. And my question has always been to that, relative to what? You know, you're in space. How would you ever know if you've completely, I mean, you know, full stop, you know, it's like the ship is still keeping track of Earth. I mean, you know, it's just, it's insane. Number four was ships traveling at faster than light can communicate with other ships or planets. And of course, actually, how would you do that? Well, exactly.
That's what they call it. Subspace, I don't know, whatever they call it.
Yeah. They use subspace. That's that's the excuse. You know, the truth is, it's really hard to it's really hard to communicate across those long distances anyway. But especially if something is moving close to the speed of light, it's going to be very hard. If it's moving faster than light without a dodge like subspace, there's no way there's no way it could ever happen. Okay, number six. Wait, did I do five? Oh, number five. This is another really fun one. Objects in space are bunched together. Actually, no, they're not. This was a problem I had, probably one of the few problems I had with the movie Serenity. You know, when they're when they're going to the planet where the Reavers are.
Yeah.
And they got to clear that.
Basically, they're blockading, the Reavers are blockading the planet, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't have a blockade in space. The only way you could have a blockade in space is if you had some really advanced technologies like the Tholians have in Star Trek, where they build these huge webs, right? You know, across light years, right? Would be the only way that would work. But it looks cool in space. In fact, one of the things they say in this article, and I didn't realize this, although it sounds about right. If you're flying through the asteroid belt, right, you won't actually see any asteroids. Chances are.
Yeah.
You know, if you got a window and you're looking out, chances
C-3PO
are if you fly straight through the asteroid
belt. The odds of making it through the asteroid belt then, you know, so.
Yeah. You know, it's not like Empire Strikes Back, right, where there's just like.
Empire Strikes Back is so awesome. That's what it needs to be, you know.
I agree. Our solar system should be more like Empire Strikes Back. Who could argue with that? Number six myth, you can communicate with aliens. And they talk about that's one that they always go to a dodge to, right?
Yeah.
In Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, they use a fun one with the babblefish. The series Farscape had something similar. It was like a slug or a worm or something like that made it possible for you to communicate. In Star Trek, they just use the universal communicator.
Translator.
The universal translator.
Which, amazingly enough, they don't ever, you know, it's hardly ever mentioned in the original series. I don't think it is mentioned in the original series, you know. So.
Yeah, I don't think so either. Yeah. It's just, you know, it's taken as a given. It's like, well, we can't tell the story we want to tell if we deal realistically with communication issues, so we don't deal with them, basically. Number seven, ray guns can actually disintegrate someone. This one is highly technical. You have to read the article. I'll put the link up in the... In the chat room, but what it comes down to is the amount of power you would need to have a good working ray gun is ridiculous. Okay, you know, you would blow yourself and everything else up if you had enough power to like focus a beam on somebody and disintegrate them. So sadly, no ray guns. Number eight, cheap energy is readily available.
But it's one way that I think that one of the reasons that would be used is that. It's just, you know, it's a way of dealing with the goriness or the violence without the gore, you know. I mean, you kill somebody on a TV show and they just disappear. Well, you know, you can sneak that past the censors, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. It's a thing I actually always liked about Battlestar Galactica, the reboot, not the original show, was that... You know, they had very advanced technology. The computer technology wasn't too advanced because they had to keep it low grade because they were afraid of another Cylon thing occurring. But their weapons, you know, their firearms were just firearms like we have today, right? I mean, they were just guns. And you know, the big, scary, ultimate weapon was still a nuke, right, in Battlestar Galactica. That was as advanced as weapons technology needed to get. And it was plenty, right? if you got spaceships... guys with guns and the ability to fire nukes at each other. You've got everything you need to make a pretty exciting story. Number nine myth. This is one that We're going to get to, we're going to touch on this a little bit later as we come to our voyage to the end of the universe. You can travel at the speed of light and no time passes elsewhere. This is a really big problem.
Yeah, relativity.
The whole issue of time dilation. The closer you go to the speed of light, the slower you're going to move through time relative to everyone else, and the faster time's going to be going by in the outside world for you. So, in fact, all that what do they call it on Star Trek when they're not using the warp engines? My mind is a complete blank. You know, they just say anyway, the regular engines where they're pushing towards the speed of light.
Impulse power.
Right? All of that time they're moving, you know, somewhere 0.25, 0.5, whatever it is, speed of light, would be having all kinds of weird impacts on when they arrive at things and how much time has passed relative, and people would be aging very slowly compared to their friends back at home, and all kinds of issues that are just never brought up. And number 10, and this is a huge one, big myth, is you can travel in space without dying of radiation sickness. We think about the radiation in space as being the radiation that is in our local solar system, but in fact, our solar system is protected by the sun. We live inside this shield. Think of it as kind of the atmosphere of the sun, the heliosphere, and that protects us from the really nasty stuff that's out there in space. There are some really, really nasty rays just kind of flying around out there ready to fry us. Plus the fact you're going so fast, even if you're just hitting random particles, they become super dangerous out there at those kinds of speeds. The bottom line is interstellar space is incredibly dangerous in ways that we can't even imagine, and in ways that we probably haven't even realistically started to try to cope with yet, because there's no real reason to, because we're not anywhere near moving into interstellar space yet. But we'd be dealing with a lot of radiation out there, and it would take shielding and just massive ships, big like you can't even imagine, to make it safe to travel in that kind of space. And of course, the bigger the ship is, right, the more power it's going to take. And it already takes an almost unbelievable amount of power to propel a ship even close to light speed, much less past it, which, you know, as we'll get into, may or may not even be possible. So basically, what this list does is it takes most of the fun out of space travel.
It's a big buzzkill, the whole thing. You know what I mean?
it's a buzzkill.
You just took my childhood, you know, enjoying Star Trek, enjoying Star Wars, and just flushed it. You just, oh well. But it's, you know, I mean, it's a reality check, and every now and then it's probably good to have one. So, so the article I sent to you, Phil, a few days ago was how to write a science fiction story, an exciting science fiction space opera type story, without breaking the speed of light.
Right. This one deals just with that first issue, and I think that's plenty. Let's talk about that. How can space travel be interesting and exciting and engaging if you can't go faster than light?
Well, I mean, there's a number of ways it has been done that they've, you know, done space opera without breaking the speed of light. And arguably, one of my favorite television series arguably has done it, and that is Firefly. Now, you know, according to what I can glean from the show and the follow-up movie, mankind had to abandon this solar system and moved out and found a new solar system, and apparently it was one that's not too far from here,
right,
relative to the rest of the galaxy.
One they got to somehow.
Something
right.
In our stellar neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then they terraformed, you know, who knows how many. We just kind of guessed before the show it might be 100 planets, you know, around this one star, and terraformed a bunch of them. And that's the galactic empire that you're dealing with there. You have you have all of the tropes, you know, of, you know, perhaps something like Star Wars. You've got an empire. You've got a Han Solo type character that's, you know, hiding out among these planets and things like that. You can tell a lot of the same stories without necessarily breaking the, you know, did he break, was he breaking the speed of light? Because he sure, you know, within one episode, he could go from planet to planet. You know, I don't know. Perhaps they're just compressing things just a little bit for dramatic effect in that. So I don't know. That's one way of doing it. That's one way to write sci-fi is to have just a solar system filled with planets that you're able to easily get from one planet to the next. And that's one way of handling it.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, it raises the interesting question, because if you can have a good story even without faster than light travel, and I think you can. You and I were talking before the show started about Tobias Buckel, his Crystal Rain and the follow-up Ragamuffin, that whole series involves some excellent space opera, some really good action, and most of it takes place in a non-faster than light context. That universe does have aliens, and it does have spaceships that go faster than light, but the characters we're dealing with primarily don't get around that way, and that's not the focus of the story. And yet, it's very engaging and very interesting. Taking it back quite a bit farther in time, when I was a kid, I used to read these Robert A. Heinlein novels that he wrote for kids. He wrote one called Red Planet. There was one called Between Planets. Have Spacesuit, Will Travel. And these were all set at that time, back in the 50s and 60s when these were written, believed to be fairly near future, when humanity would have spread out and started colonizing Mars and colonizing Venus. We didn't understand at that time that colonizing Venus was not a big doable kind of a thing. When you could still have, like, Martians living on Mars and Venusians living on Venus and all that sort of thing. And those stories were great. I mean, they were a lot of fun. And Between Planets in particular, I think, involves a rebellion. The planet Venus revolts from Earth. And basically they're having their revolution and deciding they're going to be a free and independent country. And so all of the fun space stuff that you're looking for in an adventure story, it's all there, but it all takes place within our solar system, and I think that raises the question, if say we're constrained to moving around here in the solar system, is that going to be good enough? Could space travel that really only accommodates that be a worthwhile enterprise? And do you think if that's the capability that we'll be limited to, that we'll still be interested in space, we'll still exploit space, that we'll still travel into the solar system?
Well, I think the solar system, we will live to see the colonization of Mars, I believe. Richard Branson just mentioned, I believe, in the last week or so, that he would like to be involved in starting a colony on Mars. Elon Musk has said something very similar. He believes that it's going to take a while, but that he would, you know, he would like his final resting place to be Mars. You got some people of vision that they're looking, you know, in exactly that direction. So I think if we are limited to faster than light, we will colonize this solar system, and I think we will eventually make our way to other stars, just very, very, very slowly.
Yeah, I mean, there are options. There are ways of getting there. You long-term solutions, assuming you can overcome that radiation problem that was mentioned.
Right. I think the big way of overcoming the radiation problem, Phil, is not taking our bodies with us. These bodies are just not made for that kind of thing. And so what do you do? I think you put people in a virtual world, and you have a very low-mass object that's shielded effectively for the computers that are running a virtual world for a lot of people to live in, and you shoot it towards the next star system, and that's actually quite doable.
I think it is. You're kind of jumping ahead, right? Because I wanted to come to post-human star travel. Well, that's okay. You know what? We can talk about this stuff in any order that it seems interesting to us. So. I think, and it's one of the issues that came up in that IO9 article about what happens if you don't have faster than light? Well, one of the possibilities is generational ships, cryonic ships, right? You build a big starship, and essentially it becomes the home of these folks who live there, and they travel through space, and then their children are born, and their grandchildren, you know, and you go through generations and generations and generations, and finally the people who arrive at the star that you've aimed at are, you know, thousands of years have passed, right? So a good deal of history has occurred for those people by the time they get there. That's a big challenge, first, because you got to build this really massive ship and keep it powered and supplied and resourced and all that kind of thing for a very long period of time, but also just have the continuity of the mission over that period of time, and, you know, and what happens what happens on a ship like that over that period of time. In fact, there is I cannot recall the name of it. Somebody in the chat room might help me. There's a Robert A. Heinlein novel that deals with that, an intergenerational ship where they've just kind of lost track of the fact that they're on this mission.
That they're even on a ship, huh?
And there's also a Star Trek episode that dealt with that, the original series, for the sky is hollow and I have touched the stars or something like that. I have touched the sky. There it is.
The world is hollow and I have touched the sky.
The world is hollow. That's it. Thank you. And I've touched it. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. Where they encounter an intergenerational ship where they lost the thread, right? They've devolved into their own society and come to think of it, actually, the movie WALL-E had a little of that going on too. Although they weren't particularly trying to get anywhere, they were just staying off Earth until things got cleaned up. So that's one way. Another way is you freeze people and then you thaw them out later when they get there. But I think the post-human star travel options start to sound a little more useful or a little more doable. And I would actually ease into them. I would say, okay, well, for one thing, let's say you get life extension, and you take life extension to the, you know, the final end result, which is that people don't have to die at all, right? You can live indefinitely. Well, an immortal human can take a very long trip, right? So suddenly the fact that it takes, you know, 150 years to get to Barnard Star or wherever it is you're trying to go, you know, that's a big deal if you only live 80 years, but if you're potentially going to live 1,500 years or 2,000 years or something like that, that's not as big a deal.
It's a long trip, but it's doable.
Yeah.
You know, one of the solutions mentioned in the How to Write a Sci-Fi Story was people being able to clock their own brains. If you're able to slow down your own thinking, it would make it seem like the trip is going faster, you know. You know, like your parents are always telling you when you're a little kid, if you just take a nap, you know, we'll get there faster.
Right.
Stop saying, when are we going to get there? Just lay down, take a nap. We'll be there when you wake up. That's a little bit like that. The thinking is slowed so that the trip seems to go faster. And that works if you're living a long time.
You got to have the long lifespan for that to really be an effective solution. Otherwise, that could actually be an effective solution, even if you don't have the very long lifespan. If you're taking a long trip inside this solar system, right?
Right.
If it's you know, if it's a year and a half trip out to the Oort cloud, where the colony that you're relocating to is, all of the things that they talk, well, not all the solutions they talk about. You wouldn't do an intergenerational craft to there, but you might do cryonic suspension if it's possible, or you might do, you know, some trick like that where time is sufficiently slowed, or I guess sped up, right? Your experience, subjective experience of time, is sped up to the point where it seems like the trip didn't take very long.
Yeah, I think that's a good solution. And it's in a way it's akin to the cryonics, isn't it? I mean, in both circumstances, you know, it makes the trip seem to go faster for those who are taking the trip. But you know, of course, back on Earth, time is passing at the normal rate, and by the time these folks get back, lots of time has passed for people on Earth. Maybe not so much for the people who make the trip, either through clocking their brains differently or taking a long nap. So and so there's always that problem. You get back and it's like 10 years later, and, you know, some of the people you cared about it. Well, it's, you know, lots of will have happened in that period of time.
This seemed like a month-long trip. This is always going to be the problem associated with taking long trips, right? This goes back to our ancestors and the big sailing ships of yore, right? You know, it's like, well, we're gonna go off and go around the horn and explore the South Pacific and do some trading, and, you know, I'll see you in 3 years, honey, right? Kind of thing. Back in a time when that 3 years could easily turn to eight, right? It could actually easily turn to you never made it, and you don't show up back home at all. But where things can go wrong, and suddenly you're gone for years and years, and, you know, people's lives didn't last as long back then as they do now. You could take a real chunk out of somebody's life just with a single trip, and that's kind of the sort of thing we're talking about here. And in fact, a lot of the options we look at in terms of space travel are pretty much one way. When you start thinking about who you're leaving behind and who you're going to see again, ideally you want to take everybody with you, right? Or, you know, jumping ahead again to the post-human idea, you just want to send a copy of yourself, and the real you is still back, or the original you, I should say, an alternative you is back on Earth enjoying all the people you know and. You know, leading your life while this alternative copy of yourself gets to go off and have the adventure. It's a big win-win, right, if you do that, unless the copy really misses home, which...
That's true. Well, and my thought again is that what you do with the copy is that you put him in a virtual world that's, you know, just like home. You know, you're sitting on a beach sipping pina coladas or wherever else in the world you want to be. While you're taking a trip through space, so
right,
you know, I think is probably the way that we'll accomplish interstellar travel, provided we don't get faster than light.
Right. There are a number of options here, and I think the post-human engineering of the human body provides some interesting alternatives. We can have long-lived people. We could have, you know, radiation-proof people. Right? We can solve that problem. But the more you start tinkering with those things, the closer you get to the solution, Stephen, that you referenced, which is the best people to send on long star voyages are digital people. Just from a standpoint of easier to transport, can survive the radiation, they're not going to die. I mean, they're not going to get old. They're not going to get bored because they can actually just switch off, right? Or
right.
They can be in there doing something else.
All the messiness of living, you know, I mean, there's no bodily waste to have to deal with. There's no food you got to deal with. There's even the mass of your body you don't have to deal with, you know, I mean, the amount of energy it would take to just push a person up to near light speed is incredible. So, I mean, you know, if you're dealing with a Coke can-sized probe, that's a whole lot better than trying to send a Hawaiian island to the next star. So, I think that just seems to be the obvious solution to interstellar travel if we'd never get faster than light.
If we can't go faster than light, it seems like that's where we end up. You know, I was going to do this thing where we talked about which would you prefer, which one would you do, but I can tell you right now that if the choice was cryonic suspension or, you know, dying on some intergenerational ship or being digitized, I'll take that option. Right, that's the one that it's got a lot going for it, doesn't it? I mean, it seems to have everything going.
Here's something. How do we know we're not digitized right now?
Exactly.
And in a Coke can on our way to the next star right now. Okay, I just throw that out there. So, anyway.
Wow. Hey, all these shows we've been doing about the simulation hypothesis, you really tied that in nicely. So.
Yeah, we're on our way to the Barnard Star, the Safari or someplace. And,
we're going to wake up and we're going to go, oh, wow, it was all just, wow, how about that? And look, here's the real universe. It's so much richer and more interesting. Oh, geez. Stephen, you're blowing my mind right here on right here on our voyage to the end of the universe. I love that idea. Entirely possible. Also, very ironic that we would talk about digitizing ourselves if, in fact, we are already living in a simulation. But that seems to be the nature. We talk about not only digitizing ourselves, but building simulated worlds, right? Wherein the beings in them will build simulated worlds, and the whole thing just cascades forever. Anyhow, we could talk about that all night. But I want to talk about the other side of the coin, which is, hey, what if we can go faster than light? Discovery News, big story here. The warp drive could become science fact. Let me go ahead and put that in the chat room.
Absolutely.
Chew on that.
This was on Gizmodo, wasn't it?
There's one on Gizmodo, too. I've got both of those. I'll do the Gizmodo
problem.
Link, too. Gizmodo has kind of the more accessible well, Discovery's pretty good. Let me share this one, too.
Yeah.
Here you go, folks. Read up on this. This is good stuff. Warp drive. So you read the Gizmodo article?
Me, I'm going to go with the more accessible every time. And
step us through it. So what's going on here?
Okay. NASA has like a deep science division, you know, not unlike, DARPA for the Defense Department, you know. They just deal with, you know, stuff that's just way out there. They probably are laughed at by the less geeky engineers that, you know, hard science, you know. I can just imagine there's probably a hierarchy at NASA, you know. Look at those nerds.
Right.
They think they're going to invent warp drive. Well, they've got now a basis for believing that it might be possible. And what they're looking at is something that potentially could allow us to travel. And what's interesting is light warp drive in the Star Trek series, you're not really breaking the speed of light. You know, the idea is you're warping space. Like, you take a carpet, and I've got, like, point A on the carpet and B on the carpet. If I push the carpet together where it's sort of folding in the middle, and the two points, they move very close to one another. They can, you're not having to travel the entire carpet to get to from one point to the second. Well, it's something like that with warp drive. And so you don't have to the speed of light to get to some distant point if you're able to warp space. Well, they're looking at something like, maybe we can, it appears that they've got the basis now for warping space to the point that we can travel 10 times the speed of light or the equivalent of that without breaking light. And that is pretty awesome. I did some math, Phil. You want to know how long it would take to get to Alpha Centauri to 10 times the speed of light?
I think I can answer this question because it's 4 light years away.
Right.
Approximately. Therefore, it would take 0.4 years.
What I came up with was 4 months and about 28 days, so about 5 months.
Okay.
To get
well, that
here
sounds
to
like, you know, that sounds like about 0.4 years, I think, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, that's about right. And so that's pretty good. Obviously, that's not Star Trek. You know, when Kirk talks about setting in a course, they're there before the episode is over. They're that, you know, they're thousands of light years away, but hey, you got to start somewhere, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, these guys talk about the upper limit being 10 times the speed of light, and it actually goes to show you, which sounds ridiculous. I mean, the speed of light when you contemplate it is just unimaginably fast, right? So when we start talking about going 10 times the speed of light, you are hauling ass, okay? I mean, that is really moving fast. But in Star Trek, I looked this up. I was like, well, would that be warp 10 then? What is that? What is it 10 times the speed of light? And I looked it up on Wikipedia, the source of all knowledge, and it turns out that Star Trek has always been very dodgy about saying exactly what each warp number means, and they've been a little bit
each plot, you know, they can travel at the speed of plot, you know,
exactly
whatever it
needs
to be.
That's exactly right. Yes. all we know is that if you're on impulse, you're going slower than light, and if you're at warp one, you're going light speed. I guess somebody connected with Star Trek did this table, and it showed that, like, by the time you get to warp 10, you're potentially going tens of thousands of times the speed of light, which you would have to do. I mean, in order for the premise of Star Trek Voyager was that they were way over in this other quadrant and they're trying to get back, so they've got, you know, they've got the engines maxed and they're plugging along, and it's still going to take them 7 years to get back. If you divide that all out and do the math, you're talking about traveling many thousands of times the speed of light, which no one is saying is possible. But that's what they do in Star Trek to have a compelling and interesting story. So to your earlier point, as fast as that is, it still doesn't necessarily give you all the fun stuff we want. You know, can you have a federation of planets? Can you have a galactic empire with a maximum speed of 10 times the speed of light? I'm not sure.
Yeah. It would be a very localized and one of these situations where you would only occasionally have contact. It'd be a little bit more like the American colonies were with the Brits. And, I mean, they considered themselves British citizens and everything, and you know, for many, many, many years. But you know, it was probably a really big deal when a ship in England showed up. So. I think that's kind of what you get if you've got a far flung empire, you begin to have some people that are begin to think of themselves in local terms and that break away. I mean, it would be hard to hold something like that together.
Yeah, it absolutely would. And you know, the thing is, I think that kind of scenario has been dealt with in serious science fiction. I'm trying to think of the author's name, but the book was called The Snow Queen. I remember that universe had a they were actually using they weren't using a warp drive. They were using a system of black holes that were rotating a certain way, and so you could zip through space real fast. But it always took a long time to get to the black hole, right? It was like those were always sitting way out on the edge of the solar system, and you'd have to plug along at sublight to get to that. And so even though they could instantaneously travel these interstellar distances, there were always these once you got there distances to actually get to the planet you were going to, and it became this kind of loose confederation, you know, where communication was fairly slow, and you still had that problem, which I think you would have in this in this scenario, even with a spacecraft that could go 10 times the speed of light, you still have that problem of relativistic time dilation. So people who are on the crews of those ships, you know, moving from planet to planet to planet, by the time they get home, you know, maybe subjectively speaking, all that much time hasn't passed for them, but the people they care about have aged or they're gone because of what happens when you get that close to the speed of light. And Sally says in the chat room, definitely not a galactic empire. It would be hard to have anything as cohesive as the the Galactic Republic or the Senate or the Empire as portrayed in Star Wars, or even something that always seemed a little looser than that, like the Federation in Star Trek. It seems like what you would have would be very loose.
Yeah. You know, I reminded of the article again about the how to write a sci-fi story without breaking the speed of light. One of the things it mentioned was, you know, supposing that we never find aliens, we would still end up. You could still end up with a cantina scene like from Star Wars, with all these different, you know, alternate ways that humanity develops. I thought that was a pretty interesting idea. And I think that's what you see in a very loose collection of civilizations. You know, I mean, people over here at Bernard Star are going in completely different ways. They, you know, they decide, you know, as a civilization, we're going to go mostly robotic. We're going to be cybernetic or whatever. And then you know, other places make different decisions about what kind of people they want to be.
Right.
It'd be a very interesting and loosely, you know, tied together bunch.
When you think about it, if they hadn't tied it to Earth's history, that would be the logical backstory for the Star Trek universe with the Vulcans and the Klingons and the humans, right? Those should all really be, like, originally they were one thing, right? And they broke off into these different groups at some point early on, and became these competing races, separated by great distances in space and in time, and you know, culture, and also just modifications that led them in these different directions. And in fact, for people who like Farscape, that idea was dealt with pretty extensively there around the peacekeepers and who they were. I won't spoil it for anyone who still hasn't watched the entire series Farscape. And
there is a Next Generation episode that kind of dealt with that idea, Phil. How the Klingons and humans and Romulans and a couple of extinct races were all related, and in fact there was like a secret message hidden in the DNA. If you piece together all the DNA of all these different races, there was like a hologram that came out and talked to them about their history. It was, I thought that was a pretty interesting episode.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I've not seen that episode. I gotta go look one up. That's awesome. Oh, Sally, thank you. Yeah, it was Joan Vinge who wrote, or I guess it's Joan Vinge. I never made the connection between her and Werner, but I read from the chat room that she's actually Werner's ex-wife. So there you go, who wrote the Snow Queen. Thank you. Okay, well, that takes us then to our final voyage, our voyage to the end of the universe. And now this would require advanced technology, but not necessarily faster than light. So I'm going to make the case that you can get in a spaceship and you can travel through space and through time and make it all the way to the end of the universe and never have to have faster than light. I'm actually building on a piece I wrote a few years back called My Retirement Cruise. And if you will indulge me, Stephen, I'm going to read just a small selection from that, where I said, here's what you're going to do. You're going to set out for interstellar space in a fusion-powered craft and let that to accelerate to 1G, approaching but never actually reaching the speed of light. Okay? So
yeah.
you get in that spaceship, and it's well-powered, and you can cruise along accelerating at 1G for 10 years or so.
For the folks in the chat room, what you mean by that, Phil, is you would be standing on a deck that, and if you looked at your toes, you'd be looking towards the propulsion. You'd be looking down towards the back of the ship if you were looking down at your toes, because it's the ship that's keeping you at 1G, which means you have to constantly be accelerating to maintain that 1G, right?
Yeah, exactly. Accelerating,
okay.
I'm using 1G as a speed, but you make a good point, which is on that ship, if you orient it the right way, it's going to be a very comfortable ship with not artificial gravity, it's just inertia, gives you exactly the gravity you would have on Earth. So,
kept your acceleration at a constant rate, you get 1G that way. Okay,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah, so you get the bonus experience of regular gravity, which is nice. It would be hard to come by otherwise. You got to spin things around or invent artificial gravity or something like that to make that happen. So, but here you are. You're moving at 1G, whatever that is, 16 feet per second, whatever that is. Going faster and faster, you're going to approach the speed of light. You're not going to be able to quite get to it. And if you cruise along for about 10 years or so, elapsed ship time, maybe visit a planet or two along the way, and then push on back to Earth. In my original scenario, you can come back to Earth, and thousands of years would have passed. So this is kind of my dodge. This is my alternative to cryonics, right? If you're old, and we've got good spaceships, and you want to make it to the far future, just get in a spaceship that's able to accelerate to the speed of about, or accelerate at a rate of about 1G to get close to light speed, and then you can move thousands of years into the future. You come back, and it's a post-human paradise, and they welcome you, and you get digitized up and uploaded, and then you get to live forever. So that was my idea there. But hey, you know what? You can take that idea a little bit further. In fact, you don't have to take it too much further. Make it a 20-year journey. Make it a 40, 50-year journey. I believe I read in an article on this subject written by Isaac Asimov many years ago, I was looking for a reference to it, but I couldn't find it, that in something less than 100 years, you could literally make it to the far end of the universe. Okay, so you could travel all across the universe. So that's one way of looking at the end of the universe. And after that, whatever it is, 80, 90-year period of time. Of course, we would have to have life extension to live to see that anyway. But assuming you could make that trip somehow, millions, if not billions of years would have passed. So you can make it to the end of the universe in terms of the edge of the universe, I guess, which we're always sort of on anyway, but the other side. And you can make it to, say, well, let's say the universe started 15 billion years ago, right? You could move to 15 billion years from now. So you can be on the other side, the far side of the universe, and as far into the future as the universe is currently old. And that, I think, would be a voyage to the end of the universe. Stephen, before we jump to the music, any thoughts on what you would find there 15 billion years later at the other side of the universe?
I don't know. You're getting kind of close to the heat death at that point.
Actually, you still got a long time till the heat death. You would still have hundreds of billions of years to go before that occurs. Here's my theory. Okay?
Okay.
I think that when I got to the end, I would encounter my resurrected self. Okay? That like through Julio Prisco or Tipler's or somebody's post-human regathering of all intelligent beings who would say, hey, you spent all this time and you took this big trip and there was no reason. Now come join us back in the year, and it would be something like, 2200, because we're just partying like crazy there. Here's my time machine. It's a lot easier now, and just come back with me and rejoin human civilization. That's what I think I would find at the at the end of the universe. It might sound a little self-centered, a little solipsistic, but I think I would go to the end of the universe and I'd find Phil Bauermaster waiting for me. That's my
okay, Phil.
That's my projection. Or maybe you. It might be a digital copy of you saying, geez, we've been looking for you. Come on back. I told you this was a dumb idea.
See, yeah, that's right. And you've missed more than one episode of Fast Forward Radio while you're doing it.
You've been gone for 15 billion years, for crying out loud.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
oh man,
who knows what we would find? Although I think we would find that our civilization would have completely disappeared. And I don't know. It actually gives me a little chill to think about what the universe might be like that far away and that far in time. But that is a voyage that's possible. It's a voyage that someone could take, assuming that we could build a spacecraft that could go somewhere near light speed, which the laws of physics say is possible. So we'll see.
Okay. All right. Okay, music tonight is Fragile Thing by David Nachmanoff.
Fragile Thing by David Nachmanoff?
Yeah.
All right, that sounds great. Thank you for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks, everyone, for being with us this evening. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week at the normal time, and keep watching the blog. We'll be putting in announcements about what's going to happen with our fifth-year anniversary and with our big 250th show coming up. We want you all to be with us then. And until next time, live to see it.
Doesn't take much to set her off. Steven seems to know how to calm her down. Like handling china, walking on eggshells most of the time. He treats her gently, she thinks she'll keep him round. She's a fragile thing, complicated angel with a heart of glass, checkered hat. You must be careful, she's a fragile thing, but this fragile thing will break your heart. She's a fragile thing, but this fragile thing will break your heart. Close, she always disappears. digitation, puff of smoke, cloud of ink. Whenever someone nears, she's a fragile thing, complicated angel with a heart of glass, checkered past. You must be careful. She's a fragile thing, but this fragile thing will break your heart. She's a fragile thing, but this fragile thing will break your heart. Nothing is easy. Thinks she's hardest on herself. She wears a pain and grief on her sleeve. But Stephen is not like the others. This could be different. It's gonna take time till she knows what her heart can't believe. She's a fragile thing, complicated angel with a heart of glass, a checkered past. You must be careful. She's a fragile thing.